Welcome to Focus on the Family's weekend broadcast. We hope the following program will challenge you and encourage you in your faith journey.
Good parenting looks like understanding your children, where they are, and how you can work with the Lord to help them get to the next place.
I think good parenting is knowing when to speak up and knowing when you should just shut up and listen.
To just be aware of their emotional balance or lack thereof, and instead of feeding off of that, to try and just breathe deep and deal with it.
Good parenting strategy. Sometimes just hold your tongue.
What do you think? Do those comments capture your experience as a mom or a dad? Would you maybe do things differently? Well, today on Focus on the Family, we'll look at parenting suggestions like these, and they may challenge your perspective and help you think more intentionally about how you raise your kids. We hope so. Your host is Focus President and author Jim Daly, and I'm John Fuller.
John, I think it's fair to say that parenting can be, at times, very hard work, you know, and it is something you have to do. It's like going to the gym. You got to work on those muscles if you want to improve what you look like. And the same is true in parenting. You got to put effort into it. Sometimes it's subtle. I think some of the conflict in marriage in the parenting role is because you and your spouse probably come from a different perspective on how to do that. Mm-hmm. It certainly happened with Jean and I. I mean, she wanted a real formal devotion, you know, start at 7. We're going to sing for 5 minutes, and then we're going to read the word for 10, and then we're going to share for 5, and then close in a hymn. And I was more like on the go, in the car. How do we share the Lord with what's around us and what's the story in front of us? But you've got to be mindful about what you're doing and the work that you need to do as a parent. Parenting's one of the most challenging jobs we're going to ever have. And I guess here's the bottom line, too. There's no formula that's ironclad. There's predictive things that we can do as a parent. Stay married is one of the best things you can do as a parent, to show your kids love for their mom or their dad. That's so critical. But today we're going to talk about 52 parenting principles and things you can do to do the best job you can do in being a parent. Mm-hmm.
And Focus on the Family is here to help you on your parenting journey. We have so many resources. Jim, you've said time and again, this is a treasure trove, resource-rich ministry. And we have real-life moms and dads come through sharing their hearts, and that's what we have today.
Miles, welcome to Focus.
Thank you. It's great to be with you
in the studio. I guess I should say welcome to this end of the building.
Exactly. It's nice to be down here.
You're working at the other end.
Exactly.
It's so good to have you here. And it's a great thing that you've written this book, 52 Parenting Principles. One thing that I've noticed, especially with Christian parents, we tend to think formulaically that if we do these things and we do them in the right dose and the right ingredients, then we get the right outcome. But there is this little bugger of a thing called free will. So our kids don't always do or turn out the way we expected, even with the great inputs that we may have provided. So speak to that formula problem that sometimes can pop up. It doesn't mean you don't do those things, but it's not a formula.
It's not a formula. Well, and you'll notice the book is called 52 Parenting Principles, not 52 Parenting Guarantees.
Right.
So there's a distinction there that we can make off the top. We all know that there aren't any formulas or plans that you can follow that's going to produce the perfect kids and the perfect outcomes. But the reality is, when we started having kids, that's probably what I was looking for. That's when I started listening to Focus on the Family, and I read a lot of the information from people that you had sitting here, and my desire was to avoid some of the stories that I'd heard from, you know, people I'd worked with, just people I talked to, about the strained and broken relationships that they had, you know, with their kids. And I didn't want that to be our fate. And I think you guys know that my background was in health and fitness. So when I got my master's degree, I worked with a lot of doing personal training, really, with a lot of high-level CEOs and community leaders. And people from the outside, when you look and you heard their stories from the outside, it looked like they had everything together. But when you work with people like that on a weekly basis, you know, they begin to develop a lot of trust in you, and they let their guard down, and the onion starts to be peeled back, and they start sharing things that are going on about what's going on in their family. And a lot of them had strained and broken relationships with their kids. And I thought, you know, as a young, this was even before we had kids, you know, I wasn't even married yet, but it left an impression on me. And it was at that point that I thought, you know what? I don't care how much success. I don't know what my career path is going to be, but I don't want their story to be my story.
Yeah, but it is pretty common, and especially with those people because they're high achievers. They've got their mm-hmm. lists and they're working their future and where they want to go.
Right.
So that even that can become pretty stressful for the children of those parents. You were honest, though, in the book. You did talk about your mistakes as a dad and being outwardly focused, if I recall exactly how you said it. When did you have the epiphany that maybe, even knowing the stories that you knew, I wasn't on the right path always as a dad? Mm-hmm. How did that come together for you?
Well, that's kind of how the book started. You know, after my devotional times in the morning, and our, you know, I think our oldest was probably about 7 years old, I would start making a list of things that I just thought that we should work on as parents, right? And so the list continued to develop and grow, and it was just a bulleted list of things that I thought, you know, these are things that we could focus on. And I had, I don't know, probably a dozen or so on the list at that point, and I kind of reviewed it, and I thought, you know what? All of these things are things that I'm probably contributing to, and in order for them to change, it's up to me first that I need to take 100% responsibility for what's going on, because I can only change myself. I can't control them, but I can control what I do. So if I didn't like the environment or the conflict that was developing, what could I do first? What could I change? Look inward versus looking outward.
Why is that so hard for us?
I mean, we're just not wired that
way. We're
not
wired that way.
Yeah, we're not wired that way. I want to look external. You know, I went back to school. I got my PhD basically in behavior change. How could I be the source of the problem, right?
I'm older. I am pretty good.
Yeah, I'm older. I'm wiser. You know, I have the experience. These are just kids. But I realized that that really wasn't working very well. It didn't get me anywhere. So in the book, I think the first principle is take 100% responsibility. It didn't start out as my first principle, but as I reviewed everything that I had, to me, that really was where it came to. It was, I need to start with me if I'm going to expect to see any changes in our kids.
Miles, parents are probably listening to this, and maybe they have a strong-willed teen or strong-willed two-year-old. It doesn't matter. But they're questioning, really? I mean, am I really the one that should be looking at that? You really punch that idea that contentiousness and conflict in the home is more about the parent than it is about the children. Some parents are going to say, you don't know my kid.
Yeah. Again, right there, it's the outward focus.
Right.
Right. Stop and just reset and think, okay, what can I do differently? And they'll respond differently to us, whether it's the tone we're using, the words that we're saying. You know, we're defensive by nature as well. Right. If people attack us or if they accuse us of something, we're going to naturally try to defend ourselves. And kids aren't any different than we are in that respect.
Yeah. Another principle, or at least a concept that you covered in the book, is getting feedback from your children. Mm-hmm. I love that because years ago, I think the boys were probably 5th and 7th grade, somewhere around there. I was looking at their report cards, right, electronically. Even then, they were coming that way. But I'd be going over their grades with them individually. You know, oh, that looks good. You did good in math. That's good. And, oh, English looks a little light. Then I realized, you know, maybe I should let them give me a report card. So I created this thing, Dad's Report Card. Mm-hmm. Pretty simple. 7 things that, you know, am I spending enough time with you? Do I help make you laugh? I mean, really, I think good things. But it did really open up our conversations. I do think the lowest grade I received from Troy one time was not home enough, mm-hmm. not enough time. Do I spend enough time with you was one of my questions.
Yeah.
And he gave me a C. And that crushed me. I was like, a C? I'm not a C student. So I talked to him and said, like, wow, how do I fix this? Spend more time with me? Mm-hmm. Okay, let's figure out how we can do that. That's where I came up with not traveling during the summer. Mm-hmm. I stopped traveling between Memorial Day and Labor Day. Mm-hmm. And he felt that as a commitment to him. And it's probably been one of our bedrock points in our relationship.
Mm. Well, and there it goes back to, again, you own that, right? He gave you the feedback, and you own that and made a difference. And, you know, the thing with feedback, traditionally feedback, if you've grown up in the work environment, feedback oftentimes focus on the past and what went wrong. And my impression of feedback is kind of what you did. What can I do to be a better dad? How can I get my grade better? And one of the things that's a great exercise is to, again, you have to have a high level of trust within the family unit, but who knows us better than our kids and our spouse?
Exactly.
Nobody, right? So kind of what I like to do is get feedback that's looking forward. In other words, like once a week or whatever time period you do it, just ask everybody to write down on a piece of paper for everybody that's sitting around the table, what's one thing I did really good this week, right? And then you share that. You look at it, and then they write down, what's one thing I can do better? And they share that. Huh. And the person getting that feedback can't argue about it. They can't refute it. They can't ask questions about it. And then you come back the next week and you say, okay, well, how did I do? And you repeat that over and over again. So it's looking forward. How can I become better? And they're telling us if we're willing to listen.
There's so often, and I think parents are doing a better job of this now, but the impression I have is so often just sticking with the grades. You know, your son or daughter gets four A's, a B, and a C. And we automatically go to the C, right? It's just what we do. Man, what happened in that English class? Something happened? Is the teacher good? Or what happened? It, rather than starting with, my goodness, four A's. That's so much better than what I did in seventh grade. Right. You know, something that's a little more affirming. But speak to the kind of the affirmation component. I know some psychologists talk about you need like a 10-to-1 ratio. Make sure you're affirming your child 10 times to every one critical comment that may need to be made.
Right.
It's not about just databoys, but you know, make sure you're filling their tank with a lot of catching them doing the right thing.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Well, that's right. I mean, what we focus on grows. So our, I think it's out of a good intent that we want the best for our kids. So we kind of feel like we have to point out all these things that they could do better or need to do better. But why not point out those things that we want to reinforce? The things that we want to see more of. Those are the things that we want to focus on. And what I did is I made a list of each of the kids. And I wrote down, these are things that when I just observe them through the course of the week that I really admire about them. Things that they do well, right? And I keep that list in front of me. And when I started doing that, those are the things I noticed more of and was able to reinforce and point out for them. And what you get is more of those types of things. If we're always critical to them, and if we're not sure, just ask your kids. They'll tell you. I mean, they'll share with you.
Honesty,
you know,
is not the problem there.
No, usually it's not the problem there. So, but it does need to be an intent. You know, and really the subtitle of the book is How to Bring Out the Best in Your Kids. And I didn't put it in the title, but it's really more how do we bring out the best in ourselves? More so than it's how to bring out the best in our kids. Because if we're bringing out the best in ourselves, we'll bring out the best in our kids, whatever that is.
Speaking about the best in our children's lives, I think you had a story in the book about your daughter kind of being in a room all day, which every parent would say, oh, what's going on? You know, what are they doing online, social media, whatever it might be.
Right. The suspicious mind.
Tell us. It always goes there, isn't it? Interesting. But what happened in that context?
Yeah. So this was right after COVID and the kids had gone back to school. But she noticed that there was one boy in their class that wasn't coming back. And she had known him, wasn't a great friend of it, but knew who he was. And reached out and found out that his parents were quarantining him at home for 3 months. Ooh. And so she just felt bad about it. And so what she did is she contacted all of her network of friends. And, you know, she wasn't driving it at the time. So she said, hey, send me a word of encouragement for the boy. And since they couldn't come and give her all the notes and all that kind of stuff, they texted her or emailed her what they wanted to share with this boy. And so what she was doing up in her room, which I found out about, was she was actually got cards and was writing out everything that they'd either texted or emailed to her, handwriting all these cards. She had like 20 cards. Mm-hmm. And so then what I was able to do was to drive her over to this boy's house and leave him at his front door and drive away. And again, that's one of those things where, I mean, can you reinforce that behavior? Is that always going to be the case when you go up into their room and find out what they're doing? It's not. But boy, those are the things that you can reinforce and just encourage them and just compliment them on. You know, that's the kind of character that I want to see.
Absolutely.
This Focus on the Family broadcast will continue in just a moment.
It's time to level up. Give your kids a safe, faith-focused, and biblically-based community, and so much more. Join the Adventures in Odyssey Club. Club members get on-demand access to the exciting Adventures in Odyssey series, including more than 900 episodes. With faith-building activities, parental controls, and a safe online community, the Adventures in Odyssey Club could be your best adventure yet. Learn more and start your free trial at adventuresinodyssey.com/radio.
Did you know nearly 60% of American adults don't have a will in place? That's a big number. And not having a will can leave a heavy burden for family left behind. If you need a will but don't know where to begin, let Focus on the Family help. Download our resource, 15 Questions to Ask When Preparing a Will. It's our gift to you at focusonthefamily.com/preparemywill. That's focusonthefamily.com/preparemywill.
This is Focus on the Family with Jim Daly, and our guest today is Dr. Miles Mettler, and we are so glad to have him here in the studio talking about his book, 52 Parenting Principles, How to Bring Out the Best in Your Kids, and we'll encourage you to get a copy of that book today. We're at focusonthefamily.com/broadcast, or call 800, the letter A, and the word family.
Miles, another concept you had in the book was this idea of asking permission of your children to talk with them about whatever. Mm. That seems a little backward to some parents, like, really? They're my kid.
Yeah.
Mm. Exactly. That was my thought.
I don't report to them.
That was my thought, but I also didn't like conflict. So I thought, okay, well, what can I do differently? Because, you know, no matter what the kids are doing, whatever they're doing at that time, it's important to them. It may not seem important to me, but it doesn't matter if they're playing a video game, if they're reading a book, if they're watching television, if they're doing homework, whatever. And just like us, whatever we're doing in that moment is important to them. And so an approach that I started using was just, hey, can I get your attention, right? And so what I see a lot of parents do is they'll make a comment to their kid and then keep walking. So I thought, well, that's not very effective. So I'll say, hey, can I have your attention? And then I'll just stand there and not move. And it's amazing how they respond to that. They're not used to that. You really want my attention, right? And it's just that, how would we want to be treated if we're in the middle of something and the kids ask us for something? Do I want to be interrupted? And, you know, if you take homework, for example, there's research to show that if you're involved, you know, in and focused activity, it'll take you, if you get interrupted, it'll take you 20 minutes to get back to that same level of focus. So it's really just a deference thing. And it's, I think it's a sign of respect. And it's really how we would want to be treated. And it seems formulaic. It may even seem demeaning to some parents. But, you know, if you just get in the habit of doing that, it works really well.
Well, and what you're communicating is respect.
Exactly.
And, you know, that's how they learn to give it, by receiving it, exactly. In my opinion.
I think we're modeling that.
Yeah, exactly right. Another great thing that you had in the book, which actually came to me through someone who used to work here at Focus, Clark Miller. Mm-hmm. I thought it was one of the best pieces of advice he would give and talk about, which was try to say yes more mm-hmm. than you say no. Mm-hmm. And that really caught me, especially when my boys were younger, you know, when they would come to me and say, Daddy, can we do such and such? It's so easy, especially busy dads, and saying, well, you know what, right now isn't the best time, but let me do it later.
Right.
And it was just a good wake-up call to try to say yes more often than you say no.
Right.
Speak to that.
Well, I just had the thought at one point, you know, it's easier, like you said, it's easier to say no because you don't have to put any thought into it.
Right.
Right.
And it can be a distraction. Let's go have a snowball fight.
So.
Let's go build a fort.
Exactly.
I mean, it's like, okay, wow.
Right. But, you know, we want to set a precedent so that when there's something really important, they still want to come to us.
Mm-hmm.
And I just thought, you know what? Does saying no make me a better parent? Hmm. I thought, well, not necessarily, right? And so I'm much better when they ask me something, just to take time to pause and reflect, what is it they're really asking? And it's a great opportunity to get into dialogue. You know, they're asking a lot of things like, where are my shoes and where's my books and all those kinds of things. But they're also going to ask you more significant things like, hey, I'm planning to go out to the movie with my friends.
Right.
Can I do that? Yeah. Well, what's the movie about? Now, my initial response is, no, I want you to stay home. I don't want you to go out again tonight. You've been out 3 nights in a row. No, right? But
sounds like a familiar take. Thanks a lot.
The answer may still be no, but if we give them the respect of just listening to them, having a little dialogue, letting them know that we considered our response before giving our response. Now, even if the answer is no, they're going to feel better about it because they'll know that, hey, at least we thought about it. We asked questions about it.
Yeah.
And then if we do say no, and that's where stopping and pausing and making sure that we're thinking before we talk, because once we say no, you know, you want to stick to your guns. And the only way you can do that is if you really thought through and understood what they're asking so that you can make a firm, definitive answer. Because otherwise, you know, you're going to get the kids that they're just going to keep repeating and keep repeating and keep asking. And those are the kids that often just wear you down. And they know if they keep asking enough, yeah, eventually mom or dad will say yes,
Right.
And they'll also know, like, if one parent is the yes parent and one parent is the no parent, they'll know who to go to.
And then, boy, does that get messy in your marriage.
That's not a
good thing. You said yes to them again?
Right.
So, I mean, those are good things. In fact, you had that story at the water park, which I thought was good. This is more in the activity area, not really something I want to do as a teenager.
Right.
But, you know, just saying yes to that, what happened?
Yeah. Yeah. And so what's so interesting about this was Matthew. He was like 4 years old, and we were at this great water park, right? And I was ready to be done. You know, we were there with other family and we were off by ourselves, and he wanted to go on the Master Blaster one more time, right? And I started to walk away and I said, Matt, let's go. We're done. And he didn't follow me. And I turned around and he was standing there with his arm folded and he just gave me this look. And I was just convicted. At that point, it was just like, where do I have to go? I don't have any place to go. We could go have another fun ride down the slide.
Yeah.
Right. And so my alternative could have been, Matthew, I could have gone, grabbed his arm and started walking away.
We are leaving now.
Well, where would that have gotten us? And instead what I did, I said, okay, one more ride. Are you good with that? He said, yeah, one more ride. So we went to the Master Blaster, had a great time coming down. We were done then. And, you know, the rest of the night was great.
Right. He was happy. You were happy. We're all happy.
And I wasn't late for anything. There was no reason, no good reason that I couldn't have. It was just going to take time and energy from me.
And again, creating conflict where you didn't need to create
Didn't need it. Right.
In the 52 Parenting Principles book, you also talk about building trust with your kids. And that can be hard to do, especially at the teen years. You know, they're starting to expand their wings. They want some independence. It's completely natural, but this is where oftentimes conflict starts in a bigger way. How do we help our children aspire to that better future when sometimes they're doing things that don't deserve our trust?
Right.
And you got to look over their shoulder and maybe even call them out on some things.
Right. Well, kids lie. Right?
Are you serious?
It starts at a young age.
I wish you would have told me that years ago.
It starts at a young age, and they do it for good reasons, right? They think it's going to protect them. They want to avoid the consequence for whatever reason. They think it's in their best interest at this point in time to lie about it. But I think that we have to begin from a point of trust and not from a point of doubt, because that's going to come across in the tone that we use and the words that we say.
Right.
And so let's just honor them by trusting them even when they mess up. Because it's our responsibility to teach them to be trustworthy. Now, it doesn't mean if they lie to us that there's not consequences for that, but they need to have continual reassurance and encouragement that no matter how many times they mess up, we still believe in them. And believe it or not, our kids want us to believe in them, right? Yeah. They want to please us. No matter how many times they mess up, it's in their heart to want to please their parents. And the thing we have to remember, if we're continually criticizing or condemning our kids and complaining about them, they don't stop loving us. They stop loving themselves. And that's not a good place to be.
That's a powerful point. Wow, that is really powerful. And what a great reminder of our main goal. So often, Miles, right here at the end, you know, this idea of tone and how we address issues. And, you know, sometimes Gene is so good pulling me aside saying, you may not know, you're a big guy and the way you're coming across right now is a little strong. And I would not know it. I thought I was just addressing the issue, you know, but she would say, your voice is a little stern. The boys are looking up at you. You know, they're, I think they are more fearful than they are listening. It's good to have that kind of check and to invite it because you don't always know how you're coming across.
And it's not your intent.
Especially, I think dads, you know, we're the ones in the weeds on this a little bit sometimes because we can be really strong. And especially physically, we're strong. And, you know, your kids can be a little fearful of that. So how do you encourage being mindful of all those little things that sometimes your brain is just not alerting you to how you're behaving?
Well, be open to the feedback, right? So Jean gave you the feedback, right? So she felt good enough about where your relationship is that, hey, she could talk to you about that. So that's really important.
Yeah, most of the time I'm open to it.
Well, and the other thing is, you know, you pick a time and just, you have, everybody has smartphones now, right? With a little record, you can record stuff.
Oh,
so put
true.
It on the counter and hit record.
Oh, wow.
Right?
That's
and then
accountability.
When you're interacting with the kids, just, and you'll even forget that it's on. Then push stop and go back and listen to it and listen to how you sounded to yourself.
Yeah.
I mean, the big part of this is awareness, right? There's, if you look at the behavior change model, there's kind of three steps in creating a new behavior. The first is awareness. And that's really what a lot of the book is about. How do we become aware of the things that we're doing that we can do differently? So after you're aware of something, then you're in the position to go into, okay, how can I change that? And then the third step is to create a supportive environment. Create an environment that supports the behavior behaviors we want. And sometimes it's other people that can help us stay in that zone.
And I think, you know, what I've learned and seen now that my boys are in their 20s is the critical component of loving your children. I mean, and sometimes we may think we're loving them when in fact we're just critiquing them. And we see that as love, or we're correcting them, or we're looking at the C and not the 4 A's, or whatever. Maybe it's 4 C's and 1 A. Whatever the circumstances, sometimes we lose track of the power of love, which is what God is telling us, right?
Right.
And I'm often convicted, Miles, in that idea that God has forgiven us much. And sometimes as parents, we don't use that in our relationship with our children because we set the bar at perfection. And when they fall short of it, we're on them.
Right.
And I'm so grateful that our Father in heaven doesn't treat us that way and me that way, right? When you fall short, is he right there at your throat? No. You know, he wants you to be aware of it, repent of it, and then get back into relationship with him. And it is the simple truth of parenting. It's the same concept, to show grace and love to your children. So you've done a great job. 52 Parenting Principles. What a really tangible resource for us as parents. I wish you would have written it, you know, 15, 20 years ago. What happened?
I know, right?
But this would be one I would have certainly read through and talked through and read with Gene. And man, we want to get this into your hands. What parent doesn't want to do the best job that they can do raising kids that are healthy, not perfect, but healthy? And we want to help you do that. If you can make a gift of any amount, hopefully monthly, but even a one-time gift, we'll send you a copy of Miles's book as our way of saying thank you for participating in the ministry. And you get a great resource either for yourself or to pass along to a friend or someone at church. So get in touch with us. Let us help you or someone you love do the best job they can do parenting.
We're a phone call away. Our number is 800, the letter A in the word family, 800-232-6459. And you'll find all the details at focusonthefamily.com/broadcast. And I'd like to also point out our free parenting assessment. If you'll invest 5 to 10 minutes of your time, you'll walk away with a great understanding of some of the strengths of your parenting approach and also some of the areas of growth. So we'll link over to that free parenting assessment at focusonthefamily.com/broadcast.
Miles, again, thanks for being with us. It was really good.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Thanks for being here.
And thank you for joining us as a viewer or a listener. On behalf of Jim Daly and the entire team, I'm John Fuller, and we'll invite you to join us again for Focus on the Family as we once more help you and your family thrive in Christ. You're listening to Focus on the Family's weekend broadcast. We'll take a quick break here and then return with another faith-building program for your family. Stay tuned.
Oh, hey, Mike. Got here as soon as I could. What's going on, man?
Hey, I just wanted to give you an update on my marriage.
Is it good news?
Yeah. Our marriage is going great right now. I couldn't be happier.
Dude, that's awesome.
Yeah. It's like a solid 5 out of 10.
Having a marriage that's just okay isn't where couples really want to live. Give yourself and your spouse an all-inclusive weekend where you'll slow your pace and focus on each other. Get more details at focusonthefamily.com/getaway. That's focusonthefamily.com/getaway.
Today on Focus on the Family, Brant Hansen shares a personal story about letting go of anger.
I've had to work through forgiving my dad instead of living in response to that the rest of my life, because I could say, well, it's righteous anger. He was so wrong. Like, yeah, he was wrong, but I don't want to be defined by that the rest of my life. Mm-hmm. And God has forgiven me. I've got to let go of that anger in order to be healthy.
It's pretty easy to get offended, isn't it? People at work, at home, or even on the freeway can do things that hurt our feelings. And it may seem they're trying to get under our skin, but maybe we need to take a deep breath and think about how our own attitude factors into those scenarios. Today, we're featuring a great conversation on Focus on the Family with radio personality Brant Hansen. He's got stories and insights about how you can let go of offenses and anger, even when it's hard to do. Your host is Focus President and author Jim Daly, and I'm John Fuller.
John, not long ago, we spoke with Brant Hansen on this great topic of being unoffendable. And that's the title of his book, Unoffendable. I think the larger culture has no idea what to do with the pervasive anger we see around us. And this lack of forgiveness, it is ruining our lives. The Bible says in Colossians that we should put away anger, wrath, malice, slander, and obscene talk. And then Matthew 6 says, "For if you forgive others their trespasses, your heavenly Father will also forgive you." And that is good news. Mm-hmm. Those are some of the issues you'll hear today to help you in your walk with Christ. And if you're not yet a believer, this discussion will help you also in letting go of the offenses a little better.
And Brant Hansen is well known for his unique and humorous syndicated radio broadcast. In fact, he's won an award for National Personality of the Year more than once. And he's an advocate for healing children with correctable disabilities through Cure International. And as Jim said, Brant's book is called Unoffendable: How Just One Change Can Make All of Life Better. The book has now been revised and expanded, and we have copies of it here at focusonthefamily.com/broadcast. Let's go ahead and get started with this conversation on Focus on the Family with Jim Daly.
Now, unoffendable. Mm-hmm. Let me get to it. Why are we offended so often by people, even for those of us who claim Christ and we know the fruit of the Spirit is love, joy, peace, goodness, well, self-control? Why does that guy that cuts me off on the road get to me so easily?
Well, number one, I think anger's being threatened at some level. I think we know that it's threat. So I guess somebody cutting you off at some deep level, some primal level or something is like,
he's going to get to the food before I get there or something.
Well, now you're kind of getting a little close here.
You know? Yeah. I mean, I am all these years and finally figured it out.
But there's something deep down there that's like, why are you entitled to this but not me? So we feel threatened. But that's anger across the board. There's things that make us feel threatened that should make us feel threatened.
So there is a good response, I guess.
Well, there's a natural anger that happens.
Let's describe them. Let's go with what's a normal, you know, anger response and what is over the top.
Well,
give us some idea.
If your parents are abusive or you've gone through some horrible things in your life, somebody's taken the life of a family, like anger, of course, is going to be a response to that. I mean, we're actually wired for fight or flight. We're wired to have all these physiological reactions that happen when we're threatened. The problem is, for the Christian, the idea of when does forgiveness actually begin? Or are we supposed to stay angry? Because we've been taught, and I think this is to get at your question about why this is such a big issue for Christians, we're not taught out of anger. We're told that, well, it's righteous anger. My anger is righteous, so we hold on to it. The problem is, and this is the shocking thing in the book, that when people first hear about it, they're like, that can't be true. I'm saying in the book that there is no biblical righteous anger for humans. God's anger is righteous. Yes, Jesus' anger is righteous. He's holy.
Yeah.
But for us, we're not good arbiters of our own anger. We feel threatened when we don't need to. We're supposed to get rid of anger before the sun goes down.
Mm.
That doesn't mean that it's righteous.
Yeah.
If it's so righteous, why are we supposed to get rid of it right now? And there's no good scriptural argument for holding on to anger and having entitlement to it. But the biggest reason for actual forgiveness and surrendering our so-called right to anger is because we are sinners too. Like, Jim, you know this.
Yeah, thanks.
Like you have let people down as well.
Sure.
And even if they're wrong, I've done just as bad. This is the status we have as believers. It's not because they deserve forgiveness. It's because I didn't. Wake up in the morning and realize this is going to happen. When you get on the interstate and people cut you off, you shouldn't be shocked again.
Yeah.
I can't believe this. Can you believe people? Yeah, believe it. It aggravates me too. But I've got to adjust to reality and wake up and think, today I'm going to extend the forgiveness that God has given me toward other people, and I'm not going to be shocked by their behavior.
Yeah. I remember when I wrote Finding Home, my first book, about the story of being an orphan kid, which I had to go through all that as a young boy. Mm-hmm. And one of the criticisms I received, and you deal with criticism in Unoffendable, because mm-hmm. criticism comes our way, mm-hmm. certainly as public people.
Totally.
I remember one person when I first started doing the radio program here at Focus, somebody wrote in and said, Jim Daly's voice is too high. And I went, wow, that's something I just can't help if people are offended by that. I'm sorry, and I'll pray that God would give me a bit lower voice for you. But, I mean, you can't do much about that kind of thing. But in this case, somebody reviewing the book said, Daly's best advice is to keep your expectations low, which for me, they just missed the whole point. What I was trying to say there is, one way to survive a world that is often offending you is to realize that people are people, that
yes.
mom and dad are going to let you down,
right.
that relatives are going to let you down, that you're going to let yourself down. Now, you could tag that with low expectations. I say it's realistic expectations. Would you agree?
Absolutely. And when someone says, I can't believe what my mom just said, like, think about that. Unpack that. How long has your mom been saying stuff like that?
Like, take out the trash?
Yeah, 57 years. Right. Like, well, at some point, go ahead and believe that she said that people do things like people do, and they've done it for thousands of years.
Yeah.
I mean, the first two brothers that were born, one of them killed the other one.
Yeah.
The idea that we're shocked by human behavior. If you're a Christian believer, I mean, we should be the people who are not shocked. Mm-hmm. We know what our hearts are like. We know what God's been willing to do for us. Like, so to continue for us to be constant righteous anger and just be up in arms about how everybody else is behaving doesn't make sense. We should be the ones who are the least surprised by their behavior.
I know. And I guess that realization that we are in a broken world, we're still sinners, but we're saved by grace. Thank
right.
you, Lord.
Right.
And we're trying to rectify these instantaneous impulses in us. You have, a parking lot story where you almost
sure.
got in a fight or something. Now tell yours and I'll tell mine.
You know, you may be conflating different stories.
I don't know. We'll go for it.
But yeah, I mean, like I've had... One day to the next, I'm in a parking lot and I'm pulling out and I was taking too much of the center and I was blaming the person pulling in. And then someone was in the place where I was yesterday and I was blaming him. And all that to say, we're always the victims.
Absolutely.
I mean, in our minds, and there's actually a proverb that says the first to testify always seems right.
Mm-hmm.
The first to in my mind, guess who the first to testify is? In every conflict and every inconvenience and it's me. So obviously I think I'm right. I always think my anger is righteous. But yeah, we've had that. I think I cited in the book almost getting in a fist fight about a ping pong. Sorry. I'm still laughing about this, but a ping pong thing with my church fellas. Like,
okay, this is good.
I know. Well,
confession is good for the soul.
I didn't even realize it was a fight. Like, I'm not naturally given. I don't pick up on cues, like I said. And then I realized this guy's about to punch me in the face.
Did you cheat at ping pong?
No, I was saying that the rules are the serve goes this way. Like, we were playing doubles.
So you were straightening this guy
totally.
Out.
Well, I guess. But to have to stick it out. I mean, my point in the book was we stuck it out. We're still friends. Like, we know we're broken, but people split up all the time.
Hmm.
We split up with our church family. We split up because yeah. we're constantly getting offended. This is the way the whole world operates. We should be the ones that don't. Like, we're the ones who don't because we know we're broken.
Hmm.
So we should go, yep, that's us again, and extend forgiveness as God's forgiven it to us to other people. This is what we should be like.
Now, it's one thing to laugh about these funny encounters, and they happen from time to time, but hopefully in your sanctification process, what you're driving at is they're fewer and fewer.
Yes.
In terms of occurrence, they're happening with greater time distance, right?
I think that's right.
Is that the goal? What about the person that wakes up every day, the believer who's saying, you know, I'm offended again? If you're feeling offended quite often, is that something you should look at?
Yeah, I think so. And here's the weird thing. Once we call it righteous anger, we pat ourselves on the back for being angry instead of doing the opposite, which is deal with your anger, get rid of it before the sun goes down.
How do we know it's righteous anger?
We don't. That's just it. God knows his anger is righteous because he's holy.
Okay, but some people hearing that right now are saying, no, Brant, I know what righteous anger is. When I get upset at this politician or this abortion doctor or that gay couple that lives nearby.
But see, here's the problem. You're a sinner, and God has chosen to forgive you, and it cost blood. Like, can you extend that to other people? This is not to say what they're doing is right. See, that's where people get thrown, is they're going, oh, I guess everything's okay then. You're just being a relativist. Totally not. What I'm saying is that God's been willing to forgive me. I have to forgive my anger against them because I'm the unmerciful servant if I don't.
Mm.
Look what he's done for me. Jesus makes this story very obvious. Like, one man's forgiven a lot and won't extend that to someone else. Now, that said, we should still take action against stuff. But people confuse anger with action in our culture. You probably noticed. They think tweeting about something, look how angry I am. Everybody's angry all the time about everything.
That's today's culture.
Right. But what we're called to do is actually take action to correct injustice, actually to do things. Anger does not help us do that with a clear mind.
Mm.
It actually inhibits our clear mind. We don't want our police, our military acting out of anger, but we do want them taking action. And so this is what I'm called to do as a believer, is to actually do things, sacrifice, do what I can. But patting myself on the back for being angry actually doesn't help anybody.
This Focus on the Family broadcast will continue in just a moment.
Man, I knew my marriage was falling apart. I just didn't know how to fix it.
I felt like I would always be alone, even if I stayed married.
At Focus on the Family's Hope Restored Marriage Intensive, we offer hope to couples in crisis so they can have the marriage they've always dreamed of.
For the first time, I felt like my husband truly heard me.
I've received some great tools from the counselors that have changed my life and my marriage.
To begin the journey of finding health, go to HopeRestored.com today.
Thanks for listening to Focus on the Family. Let's resume now with the balance of today's programming.
Brant, you had to wrestle with some faith issues when you were a young man. I think there were some anger issues when you were a boy. Describe what was going on and how you began to get a handle on your anger, even as a child.
Yeah, this is hard to talk about, but it's a good question, and I do reference it. I'm a preacher's kid, and we went through a lot of stuff in the home from my dad that was the exact opposite of what he was preaching. I saw him preach 3 times a week.
Right. How old were you, and how did you translate
this? All the way growing up.
And so was it, till you the thought first... it was hypocritical? Or?
Oh, totally. I was scared at home. My parents divorced when I was in 7th or 8th grade, and then remarried each other, and then divorced again. Squaring that with the reality of faith is very difficult, and it made me extremely skeptical, and I am a very skeptical person. Yeah. It's just, I'm so skeptical. And I write about this some, but just I'm so skeptical it's chased me back around to Jesus.
Because that's a good thing.
Because, yes, I think it is, because you see human nature, I think. Mm-hmm. And I don't know anybody else who does anything about it. Hmm. Like, he's the only one that acknowledges sin and then does something about it that I can find. And the things he said about how we're not good, none of us, just strikes me as, that's accurate.
Right.
So he says that, like, he's got the words of life, and I don't know where else to go. The alternatives are not appealing to me. But yeah, I've had to work through forgiving my dad instead of living in response to that the rest of my life, because I could say, well, it's righteous anger. He was so wrong. Like, yeah, he was wrong, but I don't want to be defined by that the rest of my life. Mm-hmm. And God has forgiven me. I've got to let go of that anger in order to be healthy.
Yeah. How is that translated now that you're a father yourself, and a Christian in your own home life? Not to, you know, look too closely and personally,
no, that's
fine. But if you're willing, have you felt some days where you're going, oh my goodness, I'm just like my dad. I'm just the same as him.
I'll tell you this.
And I'm sure there's good and bad in that.
Well, being a professional who talks about Jesus now on the radio, so I have this platform like my dad did. And I write, and I get attention for talking about Jesus. I honestly am very attentive. I don't want any word coming out of my mouth to be something I don't mean.
Yeah.
And I want my kids to be able to listen to my podcast or listen to my show or read my books and go, that's Dad.
Yeah. And that it's consistent.
And they do.
Yeah.
And they're grown up. They're in their early 20s now, and they still will listen because they miss me, but they at least feel like they're getting some Dad. If they listen to the podcast, they live on the different coasts. And I'm very thankful for that. I'm like, the fact that they see the public me and the private me, and they're like, that's Dad. That's big.
Yeah, and I appreciate your heart. I think in the book you mentioned a time when you were prepping for your radio program, and you were in, maybe you didn't recognize it at first, but you were going to a subscription.
Oh, no, I recognized it.
Okay, so rather than me paint the wrong picture, why don't you paint the picture?
Well, think about this. I'm a Christian radio host. I actually used to know this guy. We used to be friends, and he wasn't a believer that I knew of or anything, but he did a radio prep service, which cost a subscription. It was like $50 a month, and it gives you like the stuff to talk about that day. Mm-hmm. And so I had a password for it, and so I would download it and use it without paying. And this went on at this Christian station I was at for 6-8 months. And suddenly he emailed me while I was downloading it and said, hey, what's going on, man? Just checking in. And I was like, oh, no, he can see, you know, my IP address or something. And he knows the Christian guy is stealing his stuff. Hmm. I guess this went on for a year. I owed him like $600. And so I could barely function. I'm like, I've been stealing your – I, Mr. Christian whatever – have been stealing from you for about a year.
Huh.
And I need to send you a check for $600. And he wrote me back and said, you know what? I'm going to forgive you. Don't worry. So here's the non-Christian guy, seemingly, like, I know who I am. And we kid ourselves if we think we're not bad. And so when I recall that sort of stuff, it's very difficult not to extend that forgiveness to other people. Like, if God has let me go for being that kind of person, why can't I extend that to other people? I have to. I don't have a choice.
Is that a one-time decision, Brent?
No, it's every day. And that's what I think.
I'm thinking about a specific offense that has occurred. Do you, like, even as big as the deal with your dad, did you forgive him and move on?
No, I think it's an ongoing decision. It does get easier. But I think it's the decision to relinquish the right to anger. Because, again, you'll feel things, but it's the idea that I'm not entitled to this anymore. Because of what God's done for me. And to be sure, we know people have had family members murdered and they let go of that anger because they have to. That's the thing, too. Besides the fact that Jesus commanded us to forgive people, just physiologically, it'll lengthen your life.
Yeah.
Like, Jesus knows us, and he's giving us a way of forgiveness where we actually flourish. And if we reject that way, we're going to suffer. And again, not just physiologically, but our relationships suffer. We go through... It torpedoes other relationships because we got anger that we haven't let go of, because we're constantly living in reaction to that thing that happened to us yesterday or 20 or 40 years ago, and we've got to let it go.
Yeah. You share a story in the book about a car accident. I think that, I don't know if it was a friend of yours that was involved in this, but what happened in this car accident? Why was it an illustration that you used?
Okay, she's extremely intelligent, and her dad is a very high-ranking professor at a major university, and she's an intellect and an agnostic. She drove into a construction zone and hit a guy, and actually it cost him his legs.
Mm-hmm.
And she went and visited the hospital room, and he forgave her, and he said, it's because I believe in God, and because I'm a Christian, I have to let this go, and I want you to know I've forgiven you. Well, she's now a believer because of that.
Wow, the power of forgiveness.
Yeah, because there's nothing else in the world that would give you that resource to do that. My wife was attacked by a guy on the street last year, and we had to wrestle through this. This is after I wrote the book. So it's like, okay, now what you got? And the police didn't arrest him. I had to wrestle with that. After writing the book, the police did not arrest the guy, and he kept walking past our front window. We live on the sidewalk, practically. Like, we're in a townhouse, an old townhouse. I saw him every day walking, but my wife would see him. I went to the mayor, the police, like, why haven't you arrested this guy? He assaulted her on the street, threw her on the ground, put her in a headlock, all this stuff. Like, but we had to pray about it. And I went, and finally, I was relentless and got him arrested. But it took a long time, but I never gave up. It was like, I still was taking action, but it was like, we were praying for him to the point that we felt for him. And we actually asked for leniency in the sentencing. We wanted mental health evaluations. But we got that way because we realized we're sinners. That's a long story short.
It's a good story.
Well, and I hope people realize too, I'm not against putting someone in jail or anything like that. It was just amazing how your heart changes when you surrender that right. And I didn't give up on getting him arrested. I think it'd be really compelling in a world of offense if Christians were the ones that were not offendable, because we know we're broken.
Without a doubt. I mean, that should be the way, right?
Yeah. Wouldn't that be incredibly compelling to people? Like, yeah, there's right and wrong, but we're broken too.
Yeah.
There's all these scriptures about how anger resides in the lap of fools. It's all negative about human anger. In James 1:20, it actually says, and people never memorize this verse because it doesn't work for our theology, but the verse actually says, there's nothing about man's anger that brings about the righteousness of God. And we still think, well, my anger is righteous. Like, that's not in the Bible. God's anger is righteous. God's vengeance is righteous. He's entitled to certain things because he's holy that we're not entitled to.
That is powerful. So powerful. Let's work through a few more examples. For the Christian, what's the alternative to reacting angrily and acting offended? How do we? I mean, role play with me.
Oh, man. So I guess we'll take you to the airport, Jim.
Hey, if you can drive for me, that's perfect right there.
Well, here's the thing.
You're sitting on a plane, and you're not getting the service you think you deserve.
I think you could act without anger, and it'll be better than if you had anger. Dallas Willard said that, too. He's like, there's nothing you would do with anger that makes it better. You can do it without anger and do it better.
Okay, so you guys have brought a lot of travel examples, and I do travel, and so I've experienced some of those incidents and had some of those feelings. But I'm thinking, Brandt, of a harder place to let go of anger, and that's in the home. Mm-hmm. At home is where I find myself getting triggered. I keep a happy, nice Jesus person face on here at work, but I get home, and there's a part of me that comes out that I don't like. So what can I do before I get home tonight to kind of prepare for that?
Well, again,
because I know everything we've talked about here,
right.
But there are buttons.
But I think understanding it, first of all, that you're not entitled to righteous anger, again, and entering into, before you even go into that situation, if you can ask God on the way home for 10 seconds, like, please help me to be forgiving. Like, it's really weird, too. I've been married 28 years now. Yeah. And to continually be put off by who my wife is, and for her to be put off by me, we know all this stuff now. And to be able to practice this with each other and drop things is so fresh and so wonderful. Like, quit trying to reform everybody and police the world in your own home. It's really hard because you're living with humans. It's never going to end. You're always going to be chafing against. And again, it's not to allow all behavior. Like, well, now my kids can do whatever they want. That's not it at all. But the idea that I'm going to be continually offended that my wife doesn't give me a heads up on directions when we're driving. Mm. Like, how long is that going to go on before I'm like, yeah, we're broken and we can have a sense of humor about it? I think even allowing that we should drop things is a huge step, and then reminding ourselves before we go into it. I do think workplace is actually not easy for people, and people are constantly offended at work. And it's a great idea to go, these are the people I'm with. God put me with them, and my boss is going to do stuff that my boss does. How do I love him or her anyway?
Brandt, when you look at it, I so often think of marriage in that context. Because, how many times have we had marriage experts here, John? It's Gary Thomas or Gary Chapman or some other marriage expert. Greg Smalley, our very own. But when you get down to it, you think, why, God, why have you designed it like this? Why do you pull opposites together so often? I know not everybody is that way, but you pull introvert and extrovert together, and night owl and morning person, dark chocolate, milk chocolate. Uh-huh. And then you put them together and say, okay, make it work. And then you irritate each other. And I think, really, it's simple. It really is simple to become more like Christ, which is what? Giving, sacrificial. Not as selfish.
Totally.
And you think of that system, and then with what you're doing here with Unoffendable, it's similar in how you deal with people. Why does the Lord allow people to irritate? Well, so that you could become more like Him and look beyond that irritation to what God has created.
And this is love.
Yes.
Like, when you don't feel it, and you still extend grace to the person behind the counter or the person at work, like, apparently God is really pleased by that. Apparently it's obedience. I mean, this is what love looks like when you're not feeling it in a marriage, for instance. And
exactly
your wife,
right.
Like when I was writing the book, my wife brings me tea, and I know she's not feeling in love with me, and she's had a long day or whatever. I may have just aggravated her, and she still does it. That is love. Mm-hmm. Like, so this is a chance. It does shape us to make us more like Christ, but it's also, this is God's love language, I think, is when we do things for people that aren't doing anything for us.
Well, Brandt Hansen, you have done a wonderful job. I think this is food for thought. If we've irritated you today, be sure to contact us here at Focus on the Family.
We'll post Brandt's number.
But seriously, folks, this is where it's at. This is the action. Yeah. I would love, and I work at this every day, and I don't do it perfectly, and Gene would be the first to tell you, but it is something we as Christians need to exemplify. We should be different from the world. Mm-hmm. And this is one of the core areas. If everything's offending you, maybe you need a deeper relationship with Christ. And that's good and true for every one of us. And Brandt, you've done a wonderful job here in Unoffendable, trying to help us better understand the journey the Lord has for us. Thank you.
Thank you, guys. Appreciate it.
Well, what a good conversation today on Focus on the Family with Brandt Hansen on a really serious topic that affects so many. And if you're struggling with anger, or you're sensing your home is a powder keg, or maybe you have a real division with others, give us a call, because we have caring Christian counselors, and we'd be happy to set up a time for you to talk with one of them.
Yeah, John, and it takes a lot of energy to be angry. Think of that. And as Brandt said, letting go of that anger demonstrates God's heart for others, and you get a benefit from that as well. If this conversation has spoken to you, I want to invite you to follow up with us. Start by asking for Brant's book, Unoffendable. And if you can make a monthly gift of any amount to support the outreach of Focus on the Family today, we'll be glad to send you a copy of the book as our way of saying thank you for being part of the ministry. If you're not able to support Focus monthly, make a one-time gift and we'll send you the book as well.
Call for the book or to speak with one of our counselors. Our number is 800-232-6459. You can also find all that you need at focusonthefamily.com/broadcast. On behalf of Jim Daly and the entire team, thanks for joining us today for Focus on the Family. I'm John Fuller, inviting you back as we once again help you and your family thrive in Christ.